محمد وآل محمد اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد.
Doing a song from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight. Nearly 6 months into Israel's genocidal war on Gaza, the regime's relentless bombardment and shelling has claimed more lives in the besieged territory. The Palestinians' death toll has now surpassed 32,000, who are mostly women and children. Israel keeps expanding the scope of its crimes against Palestinians by bombing and raiding hospitals, opening fire at displaced people queuing to receive aid, and assassinating civilians with drone strikes. And all these atrocities are committed with impunity due to the unconditional support from Western powers, particularly the United States. We'll discuss that more in tonight's Spotlight program. Our guests joining us are author and political activist Eve Engler, joining us from Montreal. And from Chicago, we have political commentator Shabir Rizvi.
This is the Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Mr. Engler in Montreal. Now, attacking hospitals and shelters, it's been a hallmark of the Israeli regime's conduct throughout its genocidal assault. Now, Al-Shifa Hospital, where 30,000 Palestinians are taking shelter, has been under attack and under siege for almost a week now. Some of the details of what's going on there: Israeli forces have cut off water and electricity to the medical facility. Has the impunity of the Israelis, completely in line with the inaction of the international community, reached this point where they can push the boundaries of monstrosity and act in complete contravention of all international conventions and rules of armed conflict?
Unfortunately, it has. It's war crime after war crime after war crime after war crime. They boast about it. Israeli, soldiers boast about it online, and it looks like the U.S. is going to be vetoing another UN resolution. Israel just keeps getting the support, gets new weapons, and there seems to be almost no threshold at which they can surpass. That leads to serious consequence. It's almost beyond belief. We just have to keep raising the pressure in the countries like Canada, where I am, that have been enabling this unbelievable horror.
Mr. Rizvi, the U.S. Proposed a resolution at the Security Council earlier today, calling for a ceasefire in Gaza and a hostage deal. That was not passed as Russia and China vetoed it. Moscow and Beijing, of course, voting down the U.S. resolution. It shouldn't come as a surprise, as an immediate and unconditional ceasefire not linked to the release of the captives was all they would accept. Break down what happened today at the Security Council, and how did you view the U.S. proposal in the first place?
Yes, well, it's clear that the U.S. so-called ceasefire proposal isn't a real proposal for ceasefire. If you read the details, this basically just abides by Israel's demands without making any real concessions to the Palestinian resistance. And first and foremost, this so-called deal would allow for the full invasion of Rafah, where the Israeli army would without a doubt continue the ethnic cleansing, continue the war crimes, and continue the genocide. This is being falsely promoted, in my opinion, as a ceasefire deal in order to make Russia, China, and whoever else disagrees with that may disagree with this ceasefire proposal look like the bad guys at a time where there is more violence and more ethnic cleansing happening before our eyes. Within the actual ceasefire resolution, the quote-unquote ceasefire resolution proposed by the United States, this was basically just blanketed as Israeli demands. And they might say that, you know, they're allowing or they're asking for more humanitarian aid to come into Gaza. But what we're seeing is the delivery of the humanitarian aid is being impeded by Israeli settlers who block off access to the humanitarian aid. Two, the delivery of the humanitarian aid in itself is a weapon, because as Palestinians are being starved out, starving Palestinians run to the deliveries wherever the aid is being delivered, only to be shot down by Israeli forces or be crushed by the crates that are being airdropped anyway. So in and of itself, the delivery of the so-called humanitarian aid is actually allowing for the further elimination and ethnic cleansing of Palestinians. And last but not least, baked into that would likely be the expansion of this so-called humanitarian port that's being built on Gaza, which, by the way, the Palestinians never had access to or the ability to build their own ports in the first place due to being besieged by the Israeli occupation. This would allow the United States to then create this port, which would lead to more further occupation of Palestine, perhaps even installing some sort of U.S.-Israel partnership base to besiege Gaza even further. So the whole deal is not really a deal.
Mr. Engler, the U.S., it wants to establish a port to deliver humanitarian assistance in Gaza, but at the same time it provides weapons and lethal arsenal to the Israelis. Break down this questionable and appalling hypocrisy and inconsistency by the U.S. Many critics have described the U.S.'s involvement in efforts for ceasefires nothing but a facade.
Correctly so. There is no problem with getting food and other things into Gaza if Israel just stops blocking it by truck. And a simple way to pressure Israel to stop blocking it by truck would be to say that we are going to, at minimum, stop the weapon shipments until you stop doing that, let alone the $4 billion a year in annual military donations or aid donations to Israel that the U.S. gives, plus this plan to expand that. So this is not rocket science. There is no reason why there can't be hundreds, if not thousands, of trucks that enter Gaza every single day like they have in the past. This is just that Israel wants to collectively punish Palestinians. Israel wants to drive Palestinians out. Israel wants to make it unlivable. And it's the responsibility of those governments that have provided so many forms of diplomatic, financial, military, etc. Support to withdraw that to make sure Israel lets in food. But that's not complicated. This is a sort of all a big diplomatic game Americans are playing to act like they're getting tough on Israel. They're against the operation in Rafah because it's bad for public opinion when it comes to the U.S. internationally, and so they're making a big, huge show of visiting Blinken, visiting Israel, and acting like they're trying. I mean, if they really want this to happen, they really want there not to be a full-on onslaught on Rafah, they really want food to get in, they have to exchange that, bring in pressure. It's simple, and we're not talking about boycotting and divestment and sanctions, which many people are calling for. We're talking about just stop these huge financial subsidies that are already being given. Just withdraw this unique form of support that's already being given to this country that, going back 5 months, was a brutal apartheid state and is now engaged in a holocaust in Gaza.
Mr. Rizvi, Israel has backtracked on a photo collage of resistance fighters it claimed to have captured during the raid on Al-Shifa Hospital. Hamas had, of course, earlier dismissed the Israeli regime's allegations that tens of members of the Palestinian resistance movement had been arrested during the ongoing attack and siege of the Al-Shifa Hospital in Gaza. Hamas says that the attack on Al-Shifa is part of the systematic destruction of health facilities by the Israeli regime. Do you see it in that light as well?
Absolutely. What the Israeli regime is doing is they're intentionally attacking hospitals. And when people are in the hospitals, they're going to pull out anyone that is a military age male, which to them by definition is going to be anyone that looks remotely like a teen, all the way to maybe even the elderly. And they're going to accuse them of being Hamas just because they fit that description. This then, they turn around and tell the international community that this justifies their operations within hospitals. Everyone knows that this is false, that they are lying, but they are going to keep peddling this lie in order to continue their war crimes against these hospitals, against the Palestinian people. It's becoming clear at least to the international community. I mean, I've known about this for years. Many people that are familiar with the Palestinian issue have known about this for years, that Israel has always wanted to ethnically cleanse the Gaza Strip. It's always been a thorn on their side, and they are taking this opportunity to commit an ethnic cleansing before the world and kick out the Palestinian people. And one of their ways of doing this is, as you said, systematically destroying whatever health care is left in the Gaza Strip, which to begin with was already terrible. People couldn't get cancer treatment. People couldn't get treatments for various diseases. They actually had to leave the Gaza Strip to do it. So these health facilities were already not in great shape. They weren't allowed to have various devices, various medicines, and even doctors weren't even able to be trained properly by world health standards. And so what Israel is doing is eliminating what's left so that when Palestinians return back to the Gaza Strip, to these various hospitals, they have absolutely nothing to start off with. And so it's clear that what we're seeing here is war crime upon war crime, and they're justifying it by calling anyone that stands in their way Hamas or Hamas affiliates.
Mr. Engler, the Rafah offensive, appears to be imminent. On that issue, the U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken has called it a quote-unquote mistake. Now, that's a severe understatement to call it just a mistake, as it would be a mass slaughter of civilians taking shelter in their last refuge as their homes have been demolished. What has the international community learned over the past 6 months of this genocide unfolding? And with that, how can the international community stop this massacre of Rafah from happening?
Well, I think most of the world's population has had it confirmed that Israel, Zionism, is a absolutely brutal country, political movement that needs to be overturned, altered, radically altered, whatever you want to call it. So I think for the vast majority of the world's population, they've learned just that there is kind of no horror that Israel won't commit. For when we talk about the international community, when we talk about the powerful Anglosphere or NATO countries, Anyone with the minimum of heart, of humanism in those positions of authority and power, they should have learned at this point that the only way that Israel is going to be restrained from its most odious tendencies is to end the forms of support that we are giving to it. I mean, so no matter how many times Blinken repeats some concern about, you know, human lives being lost, there's too many, or Biden claims that he's caught in a hot mic saying that there's too many people being killed and this kind of stuff, it's a matter of bringing in something that's going to bring some form of cost to the Israeli government and, quite frankly, to the Israeli public. The Israeli public are genocidal. The Israeli public are drunk on supremacism, and they need to be restrained. They need to understand that the world's hegemon and the powerful countries are no longer going to provide the weapons, to give one example, for the Holocaust they're committing. So the international community, if, you know, Blinken at this point, if he's has any seriousness about wanting to curtail a slaughter on top of the however many slaughters that have been committed, he has to bring in some form of sanction on Israel.
Shabby Riz, a video has been released showing Israeli forces killing, or better said, executing 4 unarmed Palestinians in Gaza using drones. Now, the unfolding events of the past few days, i.e. The continued blocking of entry of aid, the siege of Al-Shifa Hospital, they clearly expose Israel's intentions of engineering this famine and contributing to this genocide that's taking place. Is this a clear indication that this massacre has not only been a war against Gaza's resistance, but against all of the population of Gaza?
I saw that footage. It was terrible. It made me tear up, just how criminal they are towards the Palestinian people. I think from day one, even, and day one being years ago, day one was on October 7th, I think from day one, Israel's sights were set on Gaza and removing all the Palestinians from there. What we're seeing right now is, for Israel, a closing window, because they feel that, you know, the United States, as Netanyahu said earlier, that they want to continue the operation with or without the United States support. We all know the United States is the main financier and the main political backer of Israel. In fact, without the United States' help, Israel wouldn't last a second. It would be crushed. And what we're seeing is an unhinged Israel that knows that the United States will support it no matter what. But now, clearly being challenged to some degree, as Joe Biden and the Democratic Party here face resistance not only in the streets of the United States, where millions and millions of people across the country weekly demonstrate for the Palestinian cause, and the Palestinian cause in the United States is more popular than ever. But now it's actually even reflecting at the polls, where in states like Michigan, which has a significantly large an Arab population and a Muslim population, They're voting uncommitted to a point where it's showing in the polls, it's hurting Biden, where 10%, 20%, 30% of people are voting uncommitted. I live in the state of Illinois, where in Chicago, a significant portion of people that typically vote Democratic are now voting uncommitted. In fact, they wrote down the word Gaza instead of uncommitted. The Palestinian cause is becoming more popular, and with this, Israel is afraid. Israel is afraid of the support that it used to enjoy throughout the international community. And so right now what it's doing is it's lashing out. And unfortunately, their soldiers also have, unfortunately for them, I should say, their soldiers have no discipline. They feel completely emboldened. If you check their Telegram channels, they're uploading videos of them torturing Palestinians, of them massacring Palestinians. And the world is seeing this. The world is seeing the Israeli experiment for what it has been since it started. These types of massacres have been happening since the 1940s, and they've happened every year since then. The world is finally waking up to the ongoing horror that Palestinians have faced. And the Israeli regime, for this part, is panicking. they see, to some extent, a window closing on that support, and they're willing to do whatever is necessary within that window to meet their goals. Those goals are clearly not being met. The Palestinian resistance is still alive and well. They still have not been able to save any hostages without massacring, without even massacring those hostages. And in fact, they've allegedly killed 70 out of the 100-something hostages with their own bombs and bullets. We're seeing this Israeli regime fall apart in real time, and with this falling apart, they're becoming more and more heinous and committing more war crimes in order to meet their political goals, but to no avail.
Mr. Engler, Iran's foreign minister has recently said the world has realized that Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has reached the end of the line and is desperately trying to survive. Now, a U.S. Intelligence report had earlier surfaced in this regard that the White House was likely searching for an alternative to Netanyahu. Is Netanyahu now a liability, even not just for Israel itself, but for Israel's allies? And do you think that he's one of the main reasons that any negotiations on a ceasefire keep failing?
Yeah, well, I think Netanyahu has been a liability, specifically the right, far right cabinet, even before the last 6 months. So there was a concern that these fascists have taken over the Israeli government. So the U.S. at this point, Netanyahu has very, very particularist, narrow personal interests in not having an election and not finding himself in jail and stuff like that. So that's all part of it. And I think that the U.S. Would prefer Benny Gantz as prime minister and have a little bit more compliant, a little bit less extreme leader leading this genocide. But there's not really that substantive difference, and this is the U.S. doesn't need to continue. They can withdraw. I mean, again, they don't have to send weapons. The shipments of weapons don't have to happen. The U.S. soldiers, the U.S. intelligence assisting the U.S. doesn't have to happen, or assisting Israel doesn't have to happen. All these different forms of support, they don't have to happen. But I think that Netanyahu is a liability, that's been the case for a long time, and yet the U.S.'s policy is to back this European colonial outpost destroying the Middle East.
Shabi Rizvi, why aren't regional blocs or even Arab governments stepping up and taking matters into their own hands? Many officials have called on Muslim and Arab countries to openly express their opposition to Israel, to blockade Israel, to cut ties with Israel. Why is that not happening?
The sad fact is that a lot of these Arab leaders are traitors. Saudi Arabia, the UAE, Jordan, they created within months, within weeks of the Yemeni blockade of the Red Sea, they created a land bridge to make sure that Israel still gets its exports, or rather gets its imports one way or another. The same could be said for Turkey, which has become one of the main exporters of fruits and vegetables to the Israeli regime, especially as Hezbollah rains down rockets on the north, which hurts their agricultural sector, only for Turkey to come around and basically give them the same goods. Of course, they have to pay more for these, but that's besides the point. A lot of these regimes are now showing their true face. These leaders are showing their true colors. They want to be part, to some extent, of the American experiment, or rather they want to play both sides of it and hope for the best. But the fact of the matter is, you can't play both sides. If you're playing both sides, then you're essentially playing into the hands of the Americans. Now is the time to pick a side. Do you want to stand with the Palestinian resistance, or do you want to stand with Israel? Do you want to stand with the U.S. hegemonic order and eventually become those victims yourselves? And I want to remind whoever is sympathetic to Saudi Arabia or to the UAE or to the Turkey that Israel has plans to expand. It's not just going to stop on occupied Palestine. There is a concept that many of Israel's current leaders float around called Greater Israel that actually expands into Lebanon, that expands into Jordan, that expands into Iraq even. And the fact of the matter is, if they don't retaliate against Israel, if they don't do something about this cancer on the region, one day the gun is going to be pointed at them. And the same people that are financing Israel right now, the United States, will be nowhere to be found, because at the end of the day, the United States wants to make the world in its own image, and they will back Israel 100% when it comes to this greater Israel project. It doesn't matter how profane it is, how destructive it is. They want to control that land. They want to control West Asia. They want to control the Middle East, whatever you want to call it. Israel serves as the 51st state of the United States, and it wants to expand. We're going to allow that to happen.
All right, that's all the time we have for tonight's show. Allow me to thank my guest, political commentator Chevy Rizvi, joining us from Chicago, and author and political activist Eve Engler, joining us from Montreal. Thank you, gentlemen, and thanks for staying with us on tonight's Spotlight. It's good night for now.
Insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
In the name of Allah, the Compassionate, the Merciful, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu Alaikum. Welcome to another edition of the program, Insights into the Holy Quran, by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom. Please stay with us.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. In the name of Allah, the Most Compassionate, the Most Merciful. Hello everyone, brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi with you with another edition of Insights into the Holy Quran. In this edition of the program, we'll discuss some of the contents of chapter Naml, the 27th chapter of the Holy Quran, as well as some of the commentary points of the verses. Brothers and sisters, let's listen to the 14th verse of Surah An-Naml.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim.
In the name of Allah, the entirely merciful, the especially merciful.
وَلَقَدْ آتَيْنَا دَاوُودَ وَسُلَيْمَانَ عِلْمًا وَقَالَ الْحَمْدُ لِلَّهِ الَّذِي فَضَّلَنَا عَلَىٰ كَثِيرٍ مِّنْ عِبَادِهِ الْمُؤْمِنِينَ
And we had certainly given to David and Solomon knowledge. And they said, Praise is due to Allah, who has favored us over many of his believing servants.
So, in the previous episodes regarding the previous verses, we mentioned shortly the story of the people of Pharaoh. They were the people who were transgressing. Their prophet, Prophet Moses, ala nabiyyina wa alihi wa alayhi salam, was granted from the side of the Almighty Allah with 9 different kinds of miracles. But they denied him. They denied him and they brought forth false accusations. They called it clear sorcery. And he called him a sorcerer, although he was the prophet of the Almighty Allah. And although their hearts acknowledged the fact and his prophethood. So why did they deny it? Because of ظلم and علوب, as the previous verses suggested. Now, that story is not explained in detail, since in the other parts of the Holy Quran, we have many other verses discussing the story of Prophet Moses. Now, the 15th verse starts with the story of Prophet Solomon, who inherits from David. So the verse says, وَلَقَدْ آتَيْنَا دَاوُودَ وَسُلَيْمَانَ عِلْمًا. And certainly, we gave David and Solomon knowledge, and they both said, وَقَالَ الْحَمْدُ لِلَّهِ الَّذِي فَضَّلَنَا عَلَىٰ كَثِيرٍ مِّنْ عِبَادِهِ الْمُؤْمِنِينَ. And they said both, praise belongs to Allah, who has favored us above many of His believing servants. So, the fact of the matter is this knowledge. وَلَقَدْ آتَيْنَا دَاوُودَ وَسُلَيْمَانَ عِلْمًا. What is this kind of knowledge? The knowledge which has been given to David and Solomon may be the kind of knowledge which is called judgment. Its reference is the verse which it says, and we gave him wisdom and a clear judgment. And also with reference to the verse which says, and unto each of them we gave wisdom and knowledge. And from these verses we can understand that it may be the knowledge of speaking with the birds with reference to the verses that explain this kind of knowledge. The verses, for example, say, we have been taught the language of the birds. Or it may be the knowledge of making the coat of mail, as the Holy Quran says. And we taught him the art of making the coat of mail. Anyway, it is better to render this Quranic word, ilm, in a general sense. That is, the knowledge of administration of the country. So, this is what we believe could be most probable.
We hope and pray that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blesses us with the ability to cover more of His divine
word. In this series of programs, we will inshallah discuss the Holy Quran with a thematic approach.
We will inshallah discuss the chapter.
وتمثل القرآن في أخلاقه وفعاله فيه الفؤاد تعلقا وتلاه في جنح الدجى متدبرا.
The context in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala speaks in this verse is the context of mentioning the ills and problems and evils of the people of the book, the previous nations who have received revelation, and more particularly the Jew.
Now let's listen to some of the verses of the Holy Quran.
First, let's listen to a few verses.
Now let's listen to some verses of the Holy Quran.
Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qum.
So, brothers and sisters, this verse starts saying, وَلَقَدْ آتَيْنَا دَاوُودَ وَسُلَيْمَانَ عِلْمًا. And certainly we gave David and Solomon knowledge, the 15th verse of chapter Naml. What is this knowledge? There are different kinds of probabilities and possibilities and interpretations when we look at the different verses of the Holy Quran regarding the explanation regarding this kind of knowledge. But this verse speaks about two other great divine prophets, David and Solomon. Of course, there is only a hint to David, but Solomon is explained more as we will turn to later on. Mentioning a part of the life story of these two prophets next to the story of Moses, عَلَى نَبِيِّنَا وَآلِهِ وَعَلَيْهِ السَّلَامِ, could be for the sake that these two prophets were from among the prophets of the children of Israel too. So the difference between their story and the history of other prophets could be that these were more successful to establish a kind of great government because of the mental and social receptivity of the atmosphere of the children of Israel. And they could expand the divine religion by the help of their governmental power. Anyway, we believe that this style of explanation of the life story of other prophets who encountered the severe opposition of their nations and sometimes they were expelled from their home and city is not seen here, and the explanations are actually totally different. And this clearly shows to what extent the difficulties may be solved and the path can be rendered into level if the divine colors succeed to form a kind of government. However, here the words are about knowledge, ability, power, dignity. وَلَقَدْ آتَيْنَا دَاوُودُ وَسُلَيْمَانَ عِلْمًا. And certainly we gave David and Solomon knowledge. So it speaks about submission of the birds and other creatures. Finally, about the severe struggle against idolatry through the way of logical invitation and then enjoying the power of government. And all these things are the qualities that separate the life story of these two prophets from that of the others. We will explain more in the next episode. Thank you for staying with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets this life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also visit our website at parsetoday.ir. Until the next program, take care.
Things always work for me. Worry ends when faith begins.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
Of Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Poreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
Hundreds of people have engaged in a 41-kilometer pilgrimage, symbolically depicting the length of the Gaza Strip and a trek that scores of Palestinians have been forced to make due to the US-backed Israeli campaign of genocide against them. The event has been organized by a collective of Christian bodies. The organizers say it is important to demonstrate that Christian Zionism does not represent them.
The church has been very complicit within this genocide and within Palestinian suppression more generally, and because of that is not condemning what they're doing, is not recognizing what they're doing as ethnic cleansing and genocide, and not speaking out. And we wanted to challenge that narrative and challenge that stance and show an expression of solidarity, show that that's not the only thing coming out of the church.
The demonstration also coincides with South Africa's commemoration of the Sharpeville massacre, when the apartheid regime gunned down 69 protesters in what is recognized as a turning point in the struggle for liberation. For those who participated, the Palestinian suffering resonates deeply.
And what I saw today in my own, as I walked, you know, because it's a pilgrimage, reflecting, I said to myself, I feel my feet, you know, burning. I feel this old legs not moving as it should. But it's nothing in comparison what people are experiencing.
The South African public is still asleep, and they must start waking up to see what Israel is doing. But what they do there, they can also come and do anywhere else in the world.
I'm a proud Jew. I'm not a Zionist, and I never have been. And I think that what the Netanyahu government is doing is actually a moral genocide. Whether they call it illegal, I don't know whether it fits legally, but it's morally a genocide. And I'm appalled. I'm heartbroken. As somebody who's lived through apartheid, we have seen this before. We should know better.
The Gaza ceasefire pilgrimage coincided with the somber Christian period of Lent, and sacrifice and resilience were recurring themes pilgrims pointed to as they attempted to symbolically walk in the footsteps of Gazans.
The Gaza ceasefire march is another example of the human resolve for justice, and as Palestinians endure the latest Israeli aggression for almost 6 months now, the people of the world will only intensify their commitment for Palestinian liberation. Hassan Sirip, Cape Town.
Afghanistan's reliance on Pakistan for access to international markets has been a long-standing challenge. However, recent disputes have pushed the Taliban authorities to seek alternatives. The Taliban have said they will invest around $35 million in Iran's Chabahar port, located in the country's southeast. The move aims to reduce Afghanistan's economic dependence on Pakistan, which has been marred by political friction and trade disruptions.
Chabahar is one of the most important economic and trade routes for Afghanistan. The Islamic Emirate of Afghanistan tries to have a strong bilateral economic and trade relations with Iran as part of its economic policy. This port allows Afghanistan to broaden its trade with Iran, West Asia, and Europe. That's why we are specially focused on Chabahar and seek to invest there.
Analysts believe this could be a turning point for Afghanistan's international trade relations. They say that Iran has been an ideal trade partner for Afghanistan, and accessing Chabahar port will further facilitate Afghanistan's regional cooperation.
The benefits of Chabahar port for Afghanistan include its short distance with the country's borders. It allows goods to enter our country at a low price. It is especially suitable with the overall economic situation of Afghans. Another benefit is that it opens a big route for our exports, which is in dire need of expansion. When we become able to expand our exports, our economy will grow rapidly.
As the Taliban government seeks to diversify its trade routes and reduce its reliance on Pakistan, the decision to invest in Iran's Chabahar port marks a significant shift in Afghanistan's economic strategy. Experts say the outcome of this move will not only impact Afghanistan's relations with Pakistan, but also shape the geopolitical dynamics in the region. Iran and Afghanistan have the potential and opportunity to cooperate in many fields. Trade and industry in particular can bring the two neighbors closer in a very volatile region. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
The recent European Council President Charles Michel's warning that the European Union needs to ramp up its military production and shift to a war economy mode in response to an alleged threat posed by Russia has sparked international alarm and mixed reactions in Europe. Earlier this week, Michel wrote in an opinion editorial run by a media specialized in EU affairs that if Europe wants peace, it must prepare for war, arguing that although the EU's military manufacturing capacity has increased by 50% since the start of the Ukraine-Russia war in 2022, far more was needed.
Our European awakening is just beginning to take shape, and I would like to tell you what I feel. The time has come to create a real union of defence coupled with a true defence single market.
Michel added that the European Union must finally take responsibility for its own security. For decades, the European Union has relied heavily on the United States and the Western military alliance NATO for its security. Analysts believe that the dependency on external powers by the 27-member bloc has resulted in a complete loss of its own geopolitical and strategic autonomy.
In questo momento,
at this point in time, the EU cannot be militarily independent. It can't adopt autonomous strategies. Today, Europe must create its own defense system so that in 30 years' time, it can really be geopolitically autonomous. If we continue to put national interests ahead, all individual states, including Italy, would lose geopolitical relevance.
Michel's remarks come as Ukrainian and international politicians and experts are warning that ammunition shortages are resulting in the losses of territory to Russia.
Michel is trying to keep Germany under pressure, demanding together with the French government that Berlin provide Ukraine with long-range cruise missiles Taurus. German Chancellor Scholz has so far said no to this request to avoid a war escalation, adding that his country has already provided Kiev with arms for 7 billion euros, while France is struggling to pay for Ukraine military aid.
On Wednesday, the Italian former Prime Minister Giuseppe Conte accused the current Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni of dragging Italy into World War III after having turned the country into an irrelevant, subjugated power. Max Civili, Rome.
Nowruz, the beginning of the Persian New Year, has always given energy and hope to people celebrating the event to observe Iranian traditions and enter the new year with a totally fresh spirit. The arrival of Nowruz for Iranians is tantamount to shopping spree and finishing their undone work. Millions of Iranians embrace the turn of the Persian year and celebrate the spring festival with many ceremonial customs waiting to be observed.
Well, everybody is busy shopping. It is time of Nowruz and the new year. I have bought sabze, sweets and fruits. We're waiting for the new year to arrive.
Sofre Hafsin is unique, symbolic for the Nowruz festivity and its tradition. The Hafsin spread includes 7 items, all starting with the letter seen in the Persian alphabet. Iranians say there's a history behind each element, including serke, vinegar, symbolizes patience and immortality, sumac represents love and compassion, sib, apple, is a symbol of health and fertility, senjit, silverberry, is seen as a simulator of love and affection, sabze, sprouts, symbolizes rebirth, seer or garlic, is a symbol of protection in the face of affliction, and samanu represents affluence.
This year it's different, as it has coincided with Ramadan, so we visit our family members and parents after iftar, and yes, it is great.
Nowruz is a unique opportunity for families and relatives to get together and visit each other. That is why Nowruz is regarded as a cultural bridge which unites people. This year, as Nowruz holidays coincide with the holy month of Ramadan, family members will most likely meet up after sunset or time of iftar when those who are fasting break their fast. Nowruz has begun and the Iranians are celebrating it as an ancient festivity to mark the first day of spring and the renewal of life and nature. This year, Nowruz has a different flavor to it, as the Iranians are celebrating it with the holy month of Ramadan together, making it an exception. Fateh Masumi, Tehran.
Earlier this month, the Maidenhead constituency in southeast England woke up to the resignation of its Conservative MP of 27 years, former Prime Minister Theresa May. Hers was one of up to 100 other well-established as well as younger MPs across the political parties announcing they wouldn't be running in the yet-to-be-announced next general election. Scottish Nationalist Party member Martin Day explains why so many are choosing to go.
For some, it's just age. They've reached retirement age and they're going. For others, they've got family commitments and they want to do that or other things with their lives. But for some, it's the toxic nature of politics. It's the toxic nature on social media where they're being trolled. And for some, they're actually being physically stalked and threatened with violence.
One MP, Caroline Lucas, the Parliament's only Green MP of 14 years, has cited the dysfunctionality of Parliament as her reason.
This Parliament has always been dysfunctional. I think perhaps one of the benefits of social media and modern television is that we see it more. It's not fit for this 21st century. I don't think it was fit for the 20th century. It's a Victorian construct, and it worked in their day. It doesn't work in our day. We should have electronic voting, we should have proportional representation systems, and we shouldn't have an unelected second chamber.
But while resignations are not uncommon ahead of a general election, it is different this time round. At least as far as the ruling Tories are concerned.
Well, you've heard the phrase, rats deserting a sinking ship. Clearly, the Tory ship is sinking, and that's why so many of them are jumping overboard and seeking refuge elsewhere.
Britons will vote in local elections in May. The Tories are 26 points behind the opposition Labour Party in opinion polls. Pressure is growing on Prime Minister Rishi Sunak to call an early national vote.
As it stands, there won't be a general election in May, but one in the second half of the year seems more likely. Nevertheless, catastrophic results in the upcoming local elections could mean that Rishi Sunak and his Conservative Party's days in power are numbered. Saipur is up, London.
South Korea this week hosts the third U.S. initiative of the Summit for Democracy. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken suggested America could lead the world toward democratic ideals lacking elsewhere.
Vitalizing democracy will also require us to shape a technological future that's inclusive, that's rights-respecting, directed at driving progress in people's lives. As authoritarian and repressive regimes deploy technologies to undermine democracy and human rights, we need to ensure that technology sustains and supports democratic values and norms.
Corralled away from the venue, activists were joined by a South Korean lawmaker to question Washington's and Seoul's credibility, particularly in light of U.S. support of Israel's ongoing genocide of Palestinians in Gaza.
Since Yoon Suk-yeol came into power, our democracy index has fallen by 19 points, and we're turning into a very backward country in terms of democracy. The United States, the enabler of the massacre, Israel, the perpetrator of the massacre, and South Korea are causing the endless decline of democracy.
Activists say the U.S. and South Korea have the blood of tens of thousands of innocents on their hands. Through the provision of weapons to Israel and failure to pressure Tel Aviv to end its genocide.
It's not the time for the South Korean government or the U.S. government, who are complicit in Israel's genocide, to discuss democracy. Instead, the Korean government should urge the U.S. and Israel to immediately stop the genocide, lift the blockade of the Gaza Strip, and end Israel's colonial military occupation of Palestine.
While a rift has appeared in U.S. support of Israel, concern is mounting that the Israeli military will increase attacks on the already besieged Rafah, where Palestinians await humanitarian aid amid reports of starvation. Like here, around the world can be found supporters of a free Palestine protesting against Israel's genocide in Gaza week after week. And here at this summit titled Democracy for Future Generations, a glaring question clouds proceedings. What will happen to the next generation of Palestinians? Frank Smith, Seoul.
The people of Afghanistan are facing immense hardship and sorrow, with the country finding itself at the bottom of the World Happiness Report rankings. The report, which evaluates nations based on various factors such as freedom, health, and income, has named Afghanistan as the unhappiest, where almost everyone is very unhappy.
Everyone here agrees with the result of the World Happiness Survey. We are unhappiest, and that is because of the ongoing poverty, unemployment, and lack of freedom and opportunities. Furthermore, girls cannot receive education, which further adds to the misery of Afghan families. When women are despaired, families feel unhappy.
I have been unemployed for almost 3 years. Since then, I have not had any income. My young daughters are missing their school, and this situation is so tough. How can we be happy? The Afghan people have suffered decades of intervention and war, and they have not been happy. But experts say, under the rule of the Taliban, their circumstances have worsened.
The Afghan people have suffered decades of intervention and war, and they have not been happy. But experts say, under the rule of the Taliban, their circumstances have worsened.
As we speak, mental clinics across Kabul are receiving more patients than ever. As a psychologist, I witnessed the rise of mental health problems such as anxiety, stress, and depression. They have even led to suicide. If you take hope away from people, it will result in a depressed and dead nation. Hope is everything for human beings. If it is eroded, all progress will be lost.
The Afghan people are resilient, but the absence of basic human necessities and rights can crush even the strongest will. The international community and the ruling Taliban share a responsibility to bring some hope and light to the life of the crisis-stricken nation. Decades of foreign interventions and war have made Afghans the poorest and the saddest people on the planet. This nation has long yearned for peace and happiness, but it remains to be seen when or whether they find their lost dream. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
The appointment of a new Palestinian prime minister at the current circumstances can deepen divisions as the Israeli war on Gaza rages. This is what some Palestinian factions revealed after President Mahmoud Abbas appointed Mohammed Mustafa, a long-trusted advisor on economic affairs, as prime minister and tasked him with forming a new government. Both Hamas and resistance movements, the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, and the Palestinian National Initiative said that without national consensus, it's a reinforcement of a policy of exclusion and the deepening of division. We met Dr. Mustafa Al-Barghouti, Secretary General of the National Initiative. He told us that the most important thing is now a unified leadership.
We're not against the new government. We're against the way the government is being formed. We want a national consensus government, a government which is acceptable and accepted by all Palestinian political groups through a national dialogue between the different groups. And that is natural because, and for us, the main goal first before forming a government is how we structure a unified Palestinian national leadership.
Mohammed Mustafa replaces Mohammed Shtayyeh, who resigned less than 3 weeks ago, citing the need for real change. Experts, however, say there had been mounting pressure on Abbas to reform the Palestinian Authority and initiate the establishment of a political framework capable of governing a future Palestinian state to take charge of all Palestinian territories after the Israeli genocidal war on Gaza ends.
First of all, that there was a pressure on Palestinian Authority to make some changes, and that's why they complied immediately and appointing Mohammed Mustafa as the new prime minister. This is on the one hand. On the other hand, which is most importantly as well, what the Palestinians wanted. The Palestinians don't want another government to be the same. The problem here is with Israel. Are they, and the international community, are they able to really make the change and let this government to work or not?
The new prime minister now would work to form a technocratic government of experts. Abbas has also asked Mustafa to create plans to reunite the administration of the West Bank and Gaza Strip, reform the government, and address internal corruption. A real political change, not a change in words only, is what the people here desire. Moreover, the upcoming government faces numerous challenges, namely rebuilding the Gaza Strip, torpedoing Israeli plans to control the coastal enclave, and managing Palestinians' lives.